morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shamba, welcoming you to the February 9th, 2021 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, my guest for the full hour is Megan Bowler Bellamy with Leadership for Educational Equity. She's their Senior Director of Elected Leadership Development. Ms. Bellamy is a political strategist and attorney whose work is focused on the intersection of social justice and elected leadership. She brings nearly 12 years of experience as a campaign manager and senior advisor on countless campaigns across the South and has worked with election officials and local advocates to ensure the seamless administration of secure elections. This also includes her previous work as the director of national programs at Verified Voting Foundation. Megan Bellamy completed her Bachelor's of Arts in English at the University of Florida and her JD, her law degree, at Howard University School of Law, and is licensed to practice law in Pennsylvania. She comes to us today from her home outside of Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Megan Bowler Bellamy.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you're the woman of the hour, and there is a Heritage Month, but I kind of like to think of this, the Heritage as a 12-month enterprise, so I won't really be giving that lip service. It's all year long we're concerned about the Black legacy in our society. Today, I'd like to explore with Megan how Leadership for Educational Equity addresses various structural, financial, social, and historical factors that reinforce disparities. I'd like for you, Megan, just briefly give us a history and the charter of Leadership for Educational Equity, which I understand is an offshoot of Teach for America.
Yes, well, it started that way, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. So today, Leadership for Educational Equity is a nonpartisan leadership development organization, and we work to inspire a diverse movement of leaders to engage civically and politically in their communities. Our focus is ensuring that every child has the opportunity to attain an excellent education. So our goal is to be one source of this type of political leader, one source of creating engaged citizens working at all levels and across all disciplines. So that includes policymakers, elected leadership, of course, and community organizers to ensure that every child has the opportunity to reach their full potential. So at its inception, it did start, well, we still work with the membership base. At its inception, the membership base was created solely from the alumni for Teach for America. But as you know, just over time, organizations evolve. And while TFA, like, it's still a core partner to the work, the movement that has been created by the members and by the organization itself is starting to expand. So we're really excited about the next chapter.
Well, that's an interesting point you make, because when I was looking around the website for LEE, is short for Leadership for Educational Equity, folks, and I get a very corporate kind of feel, and I understand sort of some of the current leadership, but you are about getting into sort of the grassroots, the local, where the people are. So your demographic target, how young are your demographic targets in the you're trying to raise up through this equity proposition?
Well, I'll say generally, most of the membership base is a little bit younger. So I would say probably in their, you know, late 20s to early 30s. But I mean, it runs the gamut. So we have some folks who are interested in running for political office specifically later on in their careers, right? Like, they have been teachers, they have been school leaders, they have seen some of the issues that the communities are facing firsthand, and they have a pretty solid idea about what needs to be done to change that dynamic. And they decide to run for office, right? So there's no age limit, and really we don't have a target per se. The vast majority of our membership base is on the younger side, but we're more interested in folks self-selecting to run for office, and whoever does, we're excited to support them in their efforts.
So meeting them where they are, both temporally and geographically, where they're rising now to this occasion, and you find each other. They find you, you find them.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I just wonder if sometimes it feels like, wow, we should have gotten to this crop of talent even earlier in nurturing their aspirational sort of development.
That's so true, you know, especially in campaigns and in politics, you know, when you're able to create a solid foundation, that can change everything. Unfortunately, just like, you know, every single organization that I've ever been a part of, including the campaigns themselves, folks are limited by resources and time. And especially in a year like 2020 was, and a year like 2020 is likely to be, in a pandemic where folks are still facing the harsh realities of their work and their family dynamics, their children not being in school in a traditional setting, it gets harder and harder to remind people of some of those issues that are still going to be facing our communities once we are back out on the regular schedule. So we try to lead with those values and help these leaders tap into their values so that we see the type of person with an equity mindset who's really looking to serve their community run for office instead of those who are more so interested in the power grab.
Oh, okay. So the fronts you're operating on and the roles that you're assuming, there's advocacy, there's tracking, and then you're monitoring trends. So what is your particular strategic sort of responsibility at Lee?
Yes. So I lead the campaign team at Lee. So we're focused on infusing that pipeline with that diverse leadership who will serve their communities, as I mentioned, and lead with their values. So some of the things that we do, we try to help demystify the process of running for office for a lot of folks. That's the first hurdle. These days, just folks in the community have a negative orientation towards politics. It's not surprising, but we try to help demystify the process and help them understand why they should start seeing themselves in those roles and why those roles and positions should be elevated and they should be taken seriously. And then we also just have a suite of services that we try to provide to our members. The first thing is coaching and leadership development. If we do nothing else, we focus on those two things because running for office is one of the hardest things they're likely to do in their lives, at least.
Increasingly, I would imagine.
Exactly. And you're facing so many different dynamics, especially our members of color, when they're out in these communities talking about very sensitive and volatile issues because of political polarization. You need some support. You need someone to talk to who understands what you're going through and who can continue to motivate you to dig deeper and stay true to your values and what you set out to achieve. So that's our core function. It just so happens that those coaches who are that main point of contact and who serve as the lead for leadership development for those members are also political campaign experts. So they can come in and help develop plans, paths to victory for these members. So not only are they getting the support, they're also getting the technical expertise to execute on their campaign.
So as you describe your roles, a successful congressional candidate out of St. Louis comes to mind, Congresswoman Cori Bush. Did she find you or did you find her? And how did that work? She is phenomenal. Her presence of mind, her composure, it's like she's been doing this for 30 years. And she's just been, she was just sworn in last month.
Yes. So she actually, Cori Bush, she did not come through our program.
What she set out to do, both in her post-primary appearances, as well as her post-January 6th, and her fending off her toxic colleague from North Georgia, whose name I'm not going to keep amplifying because it's getting too much amplification, but Cori Bush has been really an amazing profile. And so perhaps this is not a congressional candidate that you had been working with, but is a poster woman for what you will be building from here on.
She really is. And like I said, you know, we hope to be one source of leaders, but I think she's an amazing example of the type of leader that we should all be looking to support. You know, she leads with her values for sure. She speaks with authenticity from her experience, and she represents the people in her district very, very well already. We can tell that. So I think that there is a an overall shift that us as Americans, we should be looking to be a part of, whether we're running for office ourselves or supporting the right kind of candidate. But our democracy depends on our leadership leading with their values and being able to come together when those values and when those different strategies and towards that end, when those strategies differ, to bridge the gap and try to negotiate some of those differences. The hard part about today is that the differences are so stark and they're really not in areas that I think we should be negotiating around other people's right to survive, the right to live, the right to shelter, the right to healthcare, the right to live in a society where you are considered a full citizen and you are not being robbed of your right to vote at every turn. Some of these things are not areas where I think we should compromise, but that's why it's important to have strong leaders, strong elected leaders on both sides of the aisle so we can get back to making change and progress for all American people.
Well, I wanted to say beyond the matter of differences, there is the fact there are false choices in the political discourse. Do you allow your trainees, do you work with your mentees on coming out and full out saying these are false choices? Your authentic voice can run with your agenda.
We actually really do. So while we are nonpartisan and we don't ascribe to specific policies for our membership, we are an equity organization. So we do a lot of work on diversity and equity in not only how we execute this work, but the members themselves. We do a lot of values-based coaching early on in the pipeline to clearly understand why they're looking to run. And by the time they get to my piece of the team and of the work when they're actually filed candidates, we're just looking to make sure that we are getting the message of who they are and why they're running to the right voters in their districts, which is, as you can imagine, not so hard to do when you have an amazing candidate. So I do believe that there are differences of opinion, but like you said, some of the things that are coming up in the political discourse these days, they're not as simple as differences of opinion. They're differences as far as who should be included in the political process. We're also seeing an expansion of civic engagement across the board, okay, which I think is a really comforting dynamic to see, especially in the South and what we saw in Georgia. And we're hoping to add our members to that number, both as electeds and as folks working on the ground.
And we will open up Georgia and other matters more in a bit. I just want to let listeners know who've just tuned in. My guest is Megan Bowler-Bellamy, Director of Elected Leadership Development with the organization known as Leadership for Educational Equity. She's a political strategist and attorney focusing on the intersection of social justice and elected leadership here on Ask a Leader. So that is comforting to know that you're seeing a momentum build on civic engagement, and you're saying perhaps even in younger cohorts, and I'm ready to offer, there's a local power couple. He's in poli sci at UCI, and his wife is a social worker faculty member at Cal State University Dominguez Hills, and they're going to collaborate, and I'm scooping them right now. I hope they don't mind, because I just learned this from them yesterday. They're going to be collaborating on a project investigating the young voting electorate in Southern California. So I'll make sure you're properly introduced. Oh, so I want to know how much coalescing is going on. My listeners always hear me bring up this kind of factor in my guests. So you've got Fair Fight in Georgia. You brought up Georgia already. Fair Fight, there's She the People, very strategic, very targeted on, they see the people talking about policy, not biography. And so that's very clear. They want to really make this happen. So if you could sort of talk about how, and then there's Common Power. I've also had the privilege of interviewing folks from Common Power whose secret sauce is to take the talent that they're organizing, making sure the talent is getting good feedback in their volunteer capacities, but the talent they send to where the campaigns are, and they turn it over to the campaign to use them however they like. They don't impose their movement, their organizational pillars onto the campaign. They let the campaign slot their volunteers into the work. So anybody sound familiar that you're coalescing with that I mentioned here? I'm sure Fair Fight has been very closely aligned with what you're doing and some collaboration.
Yeah, and I think organizationally, typically where we find, where we're looking at having more strategic partners is more so with the membership base, as you can see. Right. So although we support our members to all be engaged civically, we don't necessarily, you know, effectuate and move through some of those plans in the same way a Fair Fight does. But we do like for our members to be in the mix as far as having those strong candidates, having those political operatives on the ground. For example, one of a Lee member, Elena Rain, she served as a senior leader on now Senator Warnock's team in Georgia, right? It's not necessarily a Lee campaign, right? But we're just looking to give our membership base the support, the motivation, and some of those tools and access to get into some of those rooms and those roles where, especially speaking as a Black woman who's come up through politics over some years, it's not always accessible. A lot of those opportunities are unpaid or they're paid for a very low salary. And when you're not able to cover your own bills, you cannot take that opportunity, right? The same as working on the Hill in some capacity. So we try to help overcome some of those barriers, point members in the right direction, serve as a point of contact if we have those contacts ourselves, so that they can be a part of that change and a part of the movement, even if the campaign isn't necessarily a Lee member campaign.
Well, I'd make it really be interested. What are some of those ways you counsel them on doing that necessary work? How do you help that person, that candidate?
Yeah, so we have a lot of, we have a few different models, typically, and I can speak a little bit more, expand on the coaching model that we have. So on top of the coaching support that we provide in the leadership development, we also have some vendor services that our member campaigns have access to. So on my team, I have a slew of professionals beyond the campaign management professionals. We have a digital team that puts together digital collateral for the campaigns. They build websites, logos, help do videos, photo shoots. Well, before the pandemic, we try to do some things creatively now remotely. We have a communications director who does training, who helps to do message testing and putting together all of the collateral that they need so they have a professional campaign, again, leading with their values. We have a data and targeting director who puts together the universe of voters that our members are looking to talk to. One of the ways that equity comes up through that is in a traditional shop. You may be given a voting universe to target that's only the super voters, right? And as you know, that
can- And tell me the super voter. It's a reliable voter or-
It's a reliable voter, most likely to vote, right? So you see people who vote in the last 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 3 similar elections.
So what do you give somebody who's been voting for about 99% of the time since 1972?
I think that's a super voter.
So that's okay. So I'm sorry, go back to
yes. So that's why you probably get a whole lot of political mail and calls. And so you can see all of that in these voter files in the tools that we have. And one of the things that we try to do is find ways and areas where we can expand the electorate. So it's including not just those super voters so that we can give members a great opportunity at victory on election day, but who are the folks who should be a part of this conversation? We have had candidates who worked overtime and raised additional money to get out additional mail and phone calls to communities and parts of their communities who are traditionally marginalized because they're not considered super voters. So typically when candidates are running for office, they're not talking to them.
So that's like a cascading effect of voter suppression. It prevents them from, I understood before that suppression, it interferes with that sort of habitual voter kind of muscle toning, voter muscle toning. So that's what you're working heavily at is converting and engaging and converting them overcoming those structural barriers to becoming a habitual voter, becoming a super voter.
Right. And that's part of the magic of what Stacey Abrams and Fair Fight and some of the other groups who've been doing this organizing for years in Georgia, this is what they were able. That's why it's so important and impressive what they were able to accomplish using the energy of what happened in Stacey Abrams' gubernatorial run and how folks felt about the voter purges, the blatant pushing out of folks who've been voting there for years, voting in their same polling place. I worked election protection during that cycle up in DC, and there were tons of calls about just election equipment being in the hallways, being unplugged, saying that in mostly Black communities that they just didn't have enough election machines, so that folks had to leave and go to work, or maybe they would get discouraged from staying in line. So what Fair Fight did, and these organizers, they were able to capitalize off of that anger and turn some folks in those communities around Atlanta, notably, who really started to see exactly how badly the establishment did not want them to vote. And they used that to expand the electorate, which now we're all reaping the benefits from.
So how do you intend to maintain the momentum then? Because you're talking about that it was comforting, that kind of result. And a lot of us that like you keep the long view in mind is how that momentum is so essential. And there's really all these disgusting micro-targeting artificial intelligence measures to undercut that momentum. So how do you stay ahead of that and keep delivering?
Yeah. And I do think that it's possible, but as you know, politics is local. So the fact that it's happening in Georgia does not mean that it's going to happen everywhere. It doesn't spread like a wildfire the same way the voter suppression does. But what I think about is how can we learn from what they did, how long it took them to do it, to get this sort of result, and start to establish those infrastructures that they already don't exist in similar areas. So I'm thinking about North Carolina and the gerrymandering, and we have a really important Senate election coming up next year. And what are some key things that we could do, right? And I think that if the state party of every single state takes a look at their unique dynamics and where the disenfranchised voters are, I think that's a good start to figure out how some of those strategies or different strategies might help the outcomes. Maybe not immediately, but they will be very much worth the investment.
So whose eyes are watching Texas?
I think everyone these days.
Okay, so but Lee is looking for tilling that soil, as it were.
We do. We have a really strong membership base in Texas. We have staff living in Texas, namely the Dallas area and Houston. But our members have been very, very active politically in Texas. And as you know, campaign finance allows it to be a really interesting cycle whenever there are a lot of Texas races, just because there are no contribution limits there. So it gets really interesting, even in some of the smaller, seemingly smaller suburban races. But I am excited for our members to dig in more and have more success in Texas. So there are over 500,000 elected offices in this country, but less than 10,000 of those offices are held by Black electeds.
Wow.
It's important to note too, that from that 500,000 elected offices, over 96% of them are local. So we have so much time thinking about national politics for obvious reasons, and those elections are really important, but 96% of the elected offices in this country are local offices. And it would really be critical for us to keep our eyes on who's in those seats, because those are some really powerful seats, especially when you think of them all together.
That really is a powerful observation to concentrate our attention on in both sides of the voter booth, for the person voting and the person on the ballot. Well, thank you for that.
So a really important outcome and statistic that came out of the 2020 presidential cycle is that the number of African Americans eligible to vote for president hit a record 30 million last year. So that's going to be critical moving forward. I think it signals the momentum that African-American voters are really engaging civically in a different way. I believe it's a show of renewed optimism and hope in the direction of the country and in their role as individual voters and as a collective voting bloc to have some say-so in who is representing them on a national and on a local level.
So to that 30 million of the Black American eligible voter statistic makes me want to flag that with the large share of state legislators and governors in control of mapping districts throughout the country, that there will be a considerable effort to undermine how many of those 30 million eligible voters will be able to have their vote counted.
That's right. In my instincts, I believe that what we saw in Atlanta was because they could not solve Atlanta in the metro Atlanta area with gerrymandering. But I do believe that this level of activity is happening and has happened over last cycle in some other metropolitan areas, but some of these votes are being drowned out by the redistricting efforts.
Right. I mean, all kinds of eligibility for being undermined. What kind of proof, what kind of available polling places, all of those deterrents. So that 30 million is a huge number at risk of being chipped away at with those disparities that we're talking about here. Well, and you're hopeful.
I am hopeful. I think that in spite of everything, that the African-American community is still showing up. And that is just the most important first step is to stay engaged, to show up, to be energized about doing everything that you can do. And also, you know, voter suppression tends to backfire at some point. So the more that you anger and try to disenfranchise communities, the more likely that they are going to turn and they are going to fight back and they're going to show up. And that's exactly what we saw happen in Georgia. And I hope to see more of that in other states across the country.
Okay. So the elections have consequences. It's a two-parter, two kind of a domain question is how consequential are the earliest appointments in the Biden-Harris administration? Are they modeling and representing elected appointments that continue the momentum that you and I have been talking about?
So I think so. We've heard a lot of talk about representation. I tend to approach representation as a framework, right? It's not an endpoint, but I also think it's important to honor the fact that like we are still at a level as a country, and certainly when we're looking at representation of all communities in their government, in a representative government, where that representation is important. We still have plenty of firsts that are popping up all over the place and in this administration. So, I mean, that's due to centuries of intentional disenfranchisement. So it's not surprising that we're still talking about representation, but I do think that it's the first step to actually reaching political leadership in the nuances of these communities who've been pushed out and typically blocked. So I'm excited to see it. I think it's a necessary first step. I think it sends a signal about the sort of administration they're looking to have. I wasn't really concerned about that, honestly, because of the presence of our new Vice President, Kamala Harris. I think that sends the biggest signal of all.
Exactly. And I wanted to get to how powerful she's already had an opportunity. We are recording this interview on January 5th, so there will be developments occurring between now and January 9th broadcast. But already, Vice President Kamala Harris has voted to split the tie already. So every time she goes into the Senate to break a tie is a representation of the most formidable type you could get so far in our American political history, no?
It really is. I think so. And I think that obviously she's faced some pushback from the Black communities and some of the more progressive factions of the Democratic Party. But I, again, her presence there is a game changer, not just because of who she is, but because of the power that she has based on the breakdown of the Senate right now. So I think we're going to see dynamic things and the rest of the Biden administration is going to follow suit.
Here's one other, it was an optic I thought was really interesting, Megan. I don't know if you saw the Oval Office meeting of Republican senators with President Biden and Vice President Harris. Did you remember that? Did you see that photo?
I did.
And then if you noticed, the women senators were sitting upright in the furniture and the male senators were sitting way back in the upholstery. And Vice President Harris was sitting back in the chair. Yes. So I thought that was power demonstrated, whether intentionally. But yes.
Yes, she's used to leading those rooms. She's used to setting the tone. I really give a lot of credit to typically when I see those dynamics and hear her talk about leadership, not just her own, but her view of women in leadership is she does not ask permission and she takes up space and she's used to leading that room. So I wouldn't be surprised if she was the first one to sit back.
It was a still photo, but I just thought that everybody was telegraphing their assumptions of power. And that was really, really interesting. So for those of you who just joined us, you're listening to Ask a Leader here on Radio KUCI. My guest is Megan Bowler-Bellamy, Director of Elected Leadership Development with Leadership for Educational Equity. She's a political strategist and an attorney focusing on the intersection of social justice and elected leadership, which you're hearing in motion now. So do you have ready to go here any sort of like case study of how you found or were found by an aspiring elected candidate, a political candidate, and how that crafting and emerging and success story unfolded? Can you lead us through maybe one or two?
We have many. Okay, so we have one member, Louisa Santos. She was running this past cycle, 2020, for Miami-Dade School Board. Louisa is a really strong member. She's from the community that she was looking to run in. She's been a teacher in that same community. And she was running a really top-notch, high-level campaign. The Miami-Dade School Board races are very competitive. And there was a lot of local on the ground political dynamics that our member was finding herself running into before she was even engaged with our team at least.
Including what was very well documented eventually of the real virulent social media platform discussions.
Yes. We're finding that more and more, unfortunately, where a big piece of our support is helping to navigate social media engagement for members, with members.
But it was a complicated demographic map with all those siloed discussions, though. And so she had to, so Louisa Santo had to deal with that. But I don't know if you could see it in real time, what the very conservative Cuban, Venezuelan, Colombian constituents in the Miami-Dade School Board jurisdiction, what their conversation was for Louisa Santo to deal with that.
Yeah, you know, it did. It rose to the top pretty quickly because it's one of those things that, I mean, it's really a function of, I went to University of Florida for undergrad, so I wasn't surprised either that yes. Some of those dynamics existed in Miami. There was also a piece with one of her strongest opponents, Dennis Moss, who'd been elected in a different seat, but he was sort of showing up in some of the numbers as an incumbent, as a known entity with high name recognition. And there was some split between the African-American community as well, between African-Americans and some of those from Caribbean descent, I believe, that there were some factions that split up there. So, I mean, I think it's an outgrowth of Miami being such a diverse community that trying to categorize and bucket folks and not really honor the nuances of all those different communities and their priorities really came to a head in this race.
Okay. So there are a lot of pillars that are part of the Leadership for Educational Equity, and I want to bring them up So that you can talk about whether that's kind of a farm team sort of early tag of what influences aspiring candidates to consider elected office. So I'm looking at the role that, and it's on your website that there's been successes in dealing with corporal punishment. That can be what trips up an aspiring civically engaged individual. It puts a mark on their record. It's a disarming, it's an undermining kind of situation if there is a disparity in how young people are handled or addressed in the school system. So I wanted to know if that overlaps with what your charter is in the political strategist.
Yeah, and I think so typically where my team would engage with an issue like that is addressing it head on and making sure, again, that those values and the members' beliefs, especially coming out of the classroom, but just having an equity lens in everything that they're doing is coming to the forefront, right? So if that is an issue that's happening on the ground, we want to make sure that voters know where this candidate stands on that and make sure that their values come through on every single piece of literature, their website, and even sometimes we push it out through other paid media opportunities.
So that's part of your political strategic array of services that you're giving those candidates is talking points around policy, a way of seeing the policy aspect of what they're trying to seek redress in, those institutional shortcomings like corporal punishment being unevenly administered in schools.
Yes. And so we would work with the member, take their stance, right? Ask their position on this issue that's really going to be core to the campaign, and then give them some message training around how to articulate what they believe and the sorts of policies they would be looking to advance should they be elected.
And what a same thing then with, I understand as of this week that the Stand Your Ground measures that were adopted in lots and lots of states, thanks to the American Legislative Exchange Council, giving the template to all those states. But there's attempts to roll back Stand Your Ground. Is that also a policy matter that you're preening your candidates on how to deal with the shortcomings of Stand Your Ground?
I don't think that I've heard the particulars of that issue come up yet with any of the candidates.
I think it's really new. I think it's really new and it's undoing.
Yeah. Should they raise it? Our comms director and our strategist would be helping them navigate that for their communities as well.
But I bring that up because there is not a symmetrical relationship between the kinds of resources the American Legislative Exchange Council has, and they are about preening candidates as well. So do you find yourselves trying to figure out how you can meet the challenge of offsetting what Alec is up to?
Well, you know, sometimes it is difficult. I'm going to be really honest on that. We're still working in a really volatile political climate. And, you know, while we do try to find opportunities to best support our candidates and decrease those barriers, there are some other political shops and orgs that they are flush with money, and that's where they lead with, and they move their agenda in a really strategic way. I think that's what makes us different, right? Like, we really look to invest in the long-term benefit of leadership development rather than just pushing specific issues forward. Our issue is building leaders. And I think that we can do that even if we're not successful on election day. Although, obviously, we'd like to be successful. And based on our statistics, we are more successful than we're not.
So how about the successful candidates? Now, we have, you were talking about Senator Warnock, and I mentioned Cori Bush, and you talked, did Luisa Santo, was she successful in her bid?
She was successful.
Okay, so do these candidates have a portion of their, we'll call it administrations, that their offices, do they sort of try to pay it back, or do they pay it forward in terms of raising the pillars that the Leadership for Educational Equity is building?
Yeah, so I would say there's no set way. Like, we don't have any expectation except that we are rooting her on. We have some policy resources should she need additional support. We help connect our elected members to each other so that they can support each other and kind of have a community of electeds who are similarly situated and have had similar experiences. But beyond that, we're here to help in case she ever has any questions or has any needs. And certainly when she decides to run for re-election, I hope. So no, I think in that way, we really try to root ourselves in the fact that our candidates become, through their experiences, that they are leaders in their own right, and we're just helping them get into office. So no, there's no set expectation for Louisa to do anything specific, although I'm really certain that she's already doing great things.
And by leading by that example is the formidable kind of optic and reinforcement of your charter.
It is. And we have other members in the Miami-Dade area who are watching that race closely, wondering whether they should take the leap as well. We have members who were working with her campaign, who were volunteering with her campaign, and folks who are going to be looking for ways to lift up their own leadership. And I think that that is one of the best ways to honor what the investment of the organization was, is to, like you said, be a great example. And she really candidate for that region in that regard, that there is a building momentum in the region because of her leadership through her campaign.
So, are there campaigns that we should know about that Lee is looking at now for the either what occurred recently in Southern California or you are seeding for the next cycle leading to 2022?
Not individually, but we have started to take a look at certain regions. We're really interested in helping members build collective power and collective action in certain regions, just based off of the needs of those communities. So no individual races yet, but I do know that we're looking to try on some different tools, decreasing some barriers around, for example, the cost of mail, the cost of just getting collateral for some of these campaign images and the infrastructure. We're looking at lengthening our timeline of working with candidates because depending on their ability to raise money to support their candidacy sooner, they tend to need our help a lot sooner than is currently projected. So again, we're taking the long game approach. I think that's, again, the unique charter of our organization, focusing on building that pipeline of leadership. But I can say, being a part of this program and this team for upwards of 6 years, I have seen the program evolve where the needs of the membership have changed and they have grown. When I started, we were maybe working with a couple of members every cycle, and now we are getting into hundreds of members every year who are seeking to run for elected office. So now we are having to grow with them. The sorts of races and opportunities they are pursuing are more complex and politically sophisticated. And I think that, again, we're meeting them where they are. So we're excited for that challenge, but focusing on the regions.
So you know that the California has just Governor Gavin Newsom just has appointed Shirley Weber to run our state election. So I don't know if that is a sort of an unexpected an asset in other representation for leadership for educational equity.
Yeah, I think it will be, and not just for educational equity, but as you mentioned, I spent some time looking at election security and election integrity
Yes.
through another organization. So I see all of these things coming together, right? There are just certain pillars of the work of fair elections, of strong representation that have to work together. And having someone like Shirley Weber in the seat serving as Secretary of State of a state like California, who, I mean, California just has such interesting dynamics when it comes to election administration. I think it's going to be amazing, especially as we continue to face challenges to voting like we never have before.
Well, and actually, we may very well have her presiding over a governor recall election coming up. So
That's right.
that, like you said, it's a complex political setting. So I don't know if the Secretary of Education in the Biden-Harris administration, Miguel Cardona, if that is providing any kinds of equity message signaling. In his confirmation process, does his confirmation process tell you anything about his being a potential ally in what you're getting accomplished?
Well, I think the main focus of what we've seen is obviously focused on COVID for good reason, and returning children to school, and just like really getting pressed on some of those, just the basics and the fundamentals of education right now, which are really difficult across the board. So I think some of that remains to be seen, right? I think that right now folks are focused on some of the more urgent needs of students in schools, but as we all know, equity issues arise through everything. So looking at access to technology while everyone's working from home, some students don't have that internet access. And I know that folks have been trying to navigate that and provide additional resources for students who are in need. So I do think in bulk it remains to be seen, but I think that he's focusing on the right things to just get started.
And speaking of the classroom, I've been wanting to ask, as I prepared for this interview, Megan, there are choices made in textbooks and in curriculum that are all about representation. And you and I, in advance of this interview, we were talking about how the Black history obscures the way it appears in, or doesn't appear at all, appears in our textbooks. If something you'd like to comment on representation and what we haven't been getting a good lesson on it. It's things, really important human details have been obscured, which are important details that you want to make authentic about your candidates. I mean, that is an intersection of curriculum and candidate sort of advancement.
It is. And just specifically thinking about social justice movements in this country and where we're headed, I think we're all finding that the vast Americans can use at least a 101 level or a refresher on basic civics and engagement and the importance of everything. I know we got a short refresher last year, just looking at, you know, is this allowed? Can this person do this? And short answer, it's supposed to be no, but we know that the truth is something usually in a gray area. I think looking at textbooks specifically, it's important to the future of our country that we're all operating from a facts-based understanding of history. I know when I look back at my own educational experiences, as a student, I was a teacher. I taught high school government for a few years in Charlotte, North Carolina. And the textbooks do not represent the students. They don't see themselves. And when they are in the textbooks, especially at that level, the first introduction is slavery. And that is not the expanse. That doesn't cover the expanse of the African-American community's contributions to this country or our history as a people. So looking at the sorts of candidates who are, you know, we say equity minded, and it does not sound like it's that big of a deal, but really having folks run for office who have experience in the classroom, who have a line of sight into the issues that are facing the next generation of our country's leaders, I deeply believe that those are the sorts of elected leaders that we need in office. So textbooks, those are one issue that come up really often, but they're very important, critical information, because that sets the foundation for that student's learning and their understanding of the world around them.
It's sort of like the first political pamphlet, wouldn't you think?
I definitely think so.
So, and it was an interesting discussion I heard on local public radio about how, and I will venture to say, maybe there's a select demographic that was calling in that in their advanced years, they really felt cheated that they weren't given an intellectually honest history lesson about the contributions. And I'm wondering when you were, and you can comment on that, and when you were teaching in Charlotte, did you get to cover what happened in Wilmington so many years ago, where that vibrant community was literally snuffed out? Did you get to teach that?
Not really. You know, I think that when it came down to the curriculum and the standards, teachers are given They're given a scope and they're given parameters for what they can cover. But I always had resources in my room and I encouraged my students to spend a lot of time there. They would even come over lunch or other times when they didn't have to, just to sit in peace and consider some other things and be exposed to other ideas that they didn't know about. So I was really excited about that. That is one of the awesome opportunities that we have with technology in the classroom, is that once students know that there's an event and you've sparked their interest in that event, they can find that information just as easily as they can find anything else. So that was one thing that I saw students just had a piqued curiosity about their own history beyond what was in that book. A lot of times because of the conversations that they were having with their parents and with their peers in the classroom.
So I do know that the lies my teacher told me, what your American history teacher got wrong, that his sales have been really brisk and he keeps pushing out new editions. So James Loewen, the author, James Loewen's thesis has always been that if history were taught in context and with intellectual honesty, it would be so much more popular a course offered by the time students are in high school. So that's a good sign, like building momentum in civic engagement elections, all of this.
Yeah, it was really exciting to see. And I think specifically because of the age of the students that I had in my classroom, they were high schoolers at the time, that, you know, they can ask and get a better sense of what some of the real dynamics were. And they see the world around them. They hear what's in the news. They see what's happening to their friends. Some of them by that time have already had interactions with law enforcement, and some of the punitive dynamics that can show up in school environments as well. So they get tipped off to the world around them. And a lot of them are curious about how we got there.
Well, this is such important work, and it'll be really interesting to watch you. This is the first time I've been acquainted with Leadership for Educational Equity. I think there are some other organizations that are capturing some of the national attention, but is that by design that you're sort of working more behind the scenes, or is the point to elevate Leadership for Educational Equity in voters' minds around the country?
Yeah, I think in the beginning, we were actively trying to stay behind the scenes. Obviously, I think that part of it, especially in a political space, is you don't want to eclipse the work of the leaders themselves, right? So even now, we don't look to run Lee campaigns or have Lee campaigns. We really just look to support the leaders who we feel should be in these offices, or at least a part of the discourse, and present themselves as an option for their community. So even now, I think that the ways that we're holding ourselves out is just to be really clear about who we are and what we support, what our values as an organization are, and how that could align with some other organizations and the work that the leaders are doing in the community. So still not looking to be, I wouldn't say front and center, but we're certainly here and happy to talk about who we are and what we're looking to achieve.
Any aspirations as we conclude the interview that you want to post us to be watching for? Anything you'd like to close with, Megan?
No, I'm so excited to have the time to talk with you, Claudia. Again, the Leadership for Educational Equity, you can learn more about us at educationalequity.org. And a lot of times if you do, you will likely engage with Lee candidates or candidates who've received Lee support without knowing that we were there supporting them. And I do think that that's totally appropriate. So excited for you all to engage more with just Lee members and all of their efforts across the country to help improve their community, specifically for kids.
And as you said, people can follow you on your website there. And so is there a physical sort of central office where you're operating from? I know people are physically separating now because of pandemic protocols, but where is the kind of the corporate office, the home office?
Yeah, we have two main hubs, so Washington, D.C. and the New York City offices, but the vast majority of our team is scattered across the country and they're rooted in their communities.
So the best way, let's say, an aspiring candidate, maybe they haven't made up their mind yet, they're not sure, what's the best way for them to approach you for consideration about whether they should run a campaign? How does that, how, what's the very, very beginning? So if anybody's listening and they're thinking, I really need to pursue this, how do you recommend they approach you?
Well, I think the first step, again, because we are a membership-based organization, I think it is establishing membership with me first, and then just letting us know what you're interested in.
Well, very good. I thank you so much. It's been really a delight to look at this sort of whole electoral process in all its intersectionality. It's really, really helpful. Thank you so much for being on Ask a Leader, Megan Bowler Bellamy.
Thanks for having me, Claudia.
My guest was Megan Bowler Bellamy, Director of Elected Leadership Development with the organization known, as we talked about, Leadership for Educational Equity. She is a political strategist and an attorney, focusing, as we talked about, the intersection of social justice and elected leadership. And for next week's show, I'm working on more candidates for the OC Board of Supervisors 2nd District March 9th special election. Janet Rappaport is stepping up. Hope to get some more candidates on. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Masks, doubling it is doubling the love.